Listeners, we're going to get to intros, but before we do that, I want to ask Logan a question right away. Logan, tell us something that you believe about real estate that might surprise us.
If you're in real estate to make a bunch of money, you're in the wrong business. And I think that many people do believe that real estate can be the best conduit to creating passive income. I don't disagree. However, if you're here to actively make income on a regular basis, I can spit off about 100 ways that might be easier for you to do that. This is a tough business. It takes a lot of work. It's hard. It's grimy. And it's worth it. But it's definitely not a get-rich-quick scheme. It's a get-wealthy-slow scheme that, if worked correctly, can be very advantageous. But don't get in this business to just try to make a quick buck.
Welcome to the Source of Commercial Real Estate podcast, where we talk to the experts in all asset classes of commercial real estate. Listen so you can grow your wealth, expand your portfolio, improve your mindset, and live an amazing life. And now, your host, Jonathan Hayek.
So who should get into this business if it's not for people looking to make a quick buck?
I think folks that... what I've seen real estate be extremely beneficial for is folks that have a really solid foundation in regards to their current income. And let me explain that. Like, many people come across real estate later in life because they may have decided that they want to do a career change, or they climbed the corporate ladder and decided that, you know, when they got to the top, it was leaning against the wrong wall. Or, you know, someone continues to hear great podcasts and reads these great books about all these success stories, and they're like, yeah, you know, I want to get into that. But, you know, frankly, a lot of folks are not suited for this business. I've been lucky enough to kind of start in this industry as a practitioner, as a real estate broker, as a property management professional, all of these different kind of things that go into real estate. That gives me a holistic view and perspective that, you know, is the good, the bad, and the ugly. I think someone who is looking for diversification, someone who is looking to maybe not have all of their eggs in one basket, or somebody who's 100% committed into being able to really pour themselves into building this skill set, that's who is really going to succeed in this business. Right now, transactions are very slim, starting to pick back up, but very slim. And that is because it's not easy right now. And when it's not easy is actually when the best opportunities come. So I'm not trying to scare people away, but usually when the bandwagon is loading up with everyone, their moms and their dads and their cousins and their sisters and their brothers, that's not usually the best time to head in that direction. The folks who actually have skills, expertise, knowledge, experience, all of those components, that is who should be really in real estate. And there's a big difference between being really in real estate and being a real estate investor. And I think that's lost on a lot of folks. And I talk to so many investors who have tried to become active with a full-time gig, and man, I wish they would just stay passive. Or passive investors that truly want to be operators, I'm like, say, you know, go be active in a smaller deal first. So I think that's kind of what I mean by that. I just don't want to kind of give the impression that real estate's for everybody and everybody should be involved in it. But it is one of those topics that most people do like to talk about, right? And so I think it gains a lot of attention in that regard. But actually operating in this business is definitely not suited for everyone.
He's Logan Freeman. He is bringing a ton of value already. Let's get to the intros. Listeners, welcome to the Source of Commercial Real Estate, where we talk to the experts in non-residential commercial real estate so you can grow your business, find a competitive advantage, and use real estate to live the life that you want. I am your host, Jonathan Hayek. I'm a former public school teacher who found financial freedom through residential real estate investing, and now I invest in larger commercial properties, particularly small industrial. And I'm talking with Logan Freeman. He's got over 6 years of dynamic real estate experience. He's executed over $300 million in acquisitions for his firm, FTW Investments, and as the head of acquisitions for a prior investment fund. Logan is also the managing broker at Exchange CRE, a boutique commercial real estate brokerage firm specializing in 1031 exchanges. Leveraging his unique blend of people skills and transactional expertise, Logan is a driving force in acquisitions, capital raising, and investor relations, and serves as a voting member of the firm's investment committee. Logan has a ton of experience. He has his hand in a lot of different areas of commercial real estate, and I'm thrilled to have this conversation with him today. Logan, we already got into it. Let's back up a few steps and tell us about your background, how you got started in real estate, and what your work looks like today.
Absolutely. And I just want to say thank you again for the opportunity and for the listeners who are tuning in, because I know your time is valuable. So I take that very seriously. The capital of Missouri, Jonathan, have any idea what it is?
Gosh, Springfield? No. You got me. You got me on the spot.
Jefferson City. And not many people know that, but that's where I grew up. And I always characterize Jefferson City in kind of Carol Dweck's perspective of the growth mindset and the fixed mindset. It's a very nice place to be. But I would say that, you know, is a place where if you do have an inclination to have that growth mindset, it's not really around you that much. It's just a very safe kind of farming community, right? And I have nothing against it. It proved to be a very good place for me. But I always had this feeling and in my bones from early on, and it probably stems back from seeing my mom work two jobs to try to put food on the table. And I was like, man, there's got to be another way, right? And I didn't know. I was 14 years old, you know, and I was like, Mom, what can I do? She's like, well, you're not quite old enough to go get a job. And I said, I think I am. You know, I'm a big guy. I can go lift something, move something, make some money, right? So I started baling hay when I was 14 years old. And I got a job at a catering business down the road, you know, washing dishes. And when I was 15 years old, I started a Roth IRA. So I was on this financial independence path of Dave Ramsey, right? You know, I remember in high school, the personal finance class being financial independence. And I do believe Dave Ramsey is an incredible businessman and is very, very knowledgeable. And for most people, his information is actually very valid. I very much disagree with him on certain aspects. But I imagine if we asked Dave Ramsey, I'm not sure or not, if he owned any real estate, I'd be interested to hear what his answer is. Not sure if he's gone public with that information or not. But, you know, I really identified as an athlete growing up, you know, and I had a good, you know, high school basketball and football career, and I had the opportunity to really take that to the next level in the collegiate space. And so I moved to Warrensburg, Missouri, and played football at the University of Central Missouri, and had an undergrad in hotel and restaurant management, thinking I was going to be in that hospitality space. About 2 years in, and all the work that I had done in that space kind of showed me I didn't want to work in that industry. And so I ended up getting a master's in business administration. But what happened was I was able to get picked up as an undrafted free agent with the Oakland Raiders after my fifth season. So I went out to camp, moved some positions, made some cuts. Then I actually got cut. So, you know, that's totally fine. I made that decision at that time to go back and finish my master's degree. And I didn't have a scholarship anymore. So I needed to get a job. I had no business experience. And so I found a job in Sweet Springs, Missouri, tiny little town about an hour away from Warrensburg. And the really cool opportunity kind of happened here. I turned my car into the classroom on wheels. And this is actually pre-podcast. So I was listening to CDs of Tony Robbins, of Zig Ziglar, of Jim Rohn and Brian Tracy and all of these individuals. And I was reading books like Think and Grow Rich, How to Win Friends and Influence People. And that led me onto this path of reading the little purple book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And so, you know, all along that lines, here's my schedule. I'd wake up at 4 a.m. because at the NFL Combine, I was 335 pounds. Well, in 6 months, I was 219 pounds. So I lost over 110 pounds in 6 months. So at 4 a.m., I'd go to the gym. I get back, get ready, get in the car, turn the CD on, drive to the job that I had at the time, which was making 265 cold calls per day, selling K through 12 curated data to vendors, getting told no 264 times a day, getting back in the car, heading to my master's program and going to class, you know, from 6 to 9 every single night, and spending 10 hours in the library on Saturdays, knocking out the work. So, you know, that was a really interesting period in my life, because there was a big mental shift. Obviously, there was a big physical shift, but there was a big mental shift in how I was thinking. And then something big happened. I call these decision points in your life. My dad had really struggled his whole life with drugs and alcohol addiction. And unfortunately, he had some medical complications from that and ended up passing away pretty abruptly. And you know, that's so, you know, I'm a 24-year-old guy. You know, I'm not an athlete anymore. I'm getting ready to start a new job with Jimmy John's as a franchise consultant, the youngest one they had ever hired. And my dad passes away. And that was kind of a big point in my life of really trying to figure out who I was. And so I delayed the starting of the job for a little bit, went to Champaign, Illinois. Then I went to Ann Arbor, Michigan, worked, came back to Kansas City, was a franchise consultant for about 12 months, kind of talked to my direct report and was like, hey man, you know, I'm doing pretty good at this job. I'm ranked pretty high here in the company. Like, what's next for me? He goes, man, you're the youngest dude in the company, man. You got to put your time in. Gave him my 2 weeks and said, I'm going to go find something else. And so I went over and started at a sales job at a startup company. So I went from a very successful franchise to a company with 3 people, and learned a lot about myself in that time period as well. Fast forward a little bit, you know, I'm getting married. I had taken a different role at a different company and just got married. And about 13 months into that job, private equity comes in, buys that company, lays off the whole sales company. So I'm about 25, 26 years old, maybe 27 at the time, thinking about, what am I going to do? And my wife said, hey, I support you 100%. You should focus on what you want to. Well, I had read, you know, 700, 750 books, had all this knowledge. I'm not a normal reader, though. I read and then I write book reports, and I really try to dive into that information and really ingrain it in my knowledge base in my mind. And so I started a sales consulting company, and I grabbed Inc.'s fastest 5,000 companies. I called the first 2,000 of them, and I landed 3 full-time jobs paying me $265 an hour. Doing what? Making cold calls, setting up CRM systems, flying to Orlando and pitching their products. At the same time, a buddy of mine just landed a large fund buying single family homes, implementing the buy, renovate, rent out, and refinance model at scale. And he said, my head of acquisitions just left and I need somebody to come on and really hunt these deals down. I said, I'll do it. So I got this full-time consulting gig. I got this full-time head of acquisitions gig. No kids at the time. I have 3 babies now, but I didn't have any kids at the time. So I had a lot of time on my hands. And so, you know, 6 months in, you know, I'm rocking and rolling. My wife is very strategic. She said, you know, all you do is kind of complain about this consulting thing, and all you do is talk about real estate. And that was all I needed. And so I dissolved the sales consulting thing, ended up doing close to 200 transactions in 1 year for this firm and this fund, which was unbelievable. And decided at that point that I wanted to learn how this fund was set up. And after I did, I went to the Secrets of Successful Syndication event by the real estate guys down in Texas. And I was like, you know what? I think this is the model that I want to focus on, but not on single family homes. So this is around 2019. And I start to do a lot of brokerage business on the 1031 exchange side for buyer side clients. I was already, you know, in the know of how to go and find properties. And so I was very successful at that, put a little change in my pocket, bought a couple properties myself. And I'm sure we'll get into these, but, you know, lost a lot of money, you know, thinking that everything that I was going to touch turned to gold. Had some mentors basically say, hey man, you need to really be thinking about this as a business. So it took another year or so, and I found some business partners. And that's kind of where we're at now, which is our companies are FTW Investments and Exchange Commercial Real Estate. That's the brokerage business. And we have been able to acquire around 1,500 multifamily units and 600,000 square feet of commercial space across 4 states here in the Midwest. We have residential property management, commercial property management, and the brokerage business as well. And that's where we're at now. And so that's kind of been my trajectory, my story, and how I got into real estate, Jonathan.
Logan, there's a lot that I admire about your story. There's I connect with a lot of it. I love how much you read. You're clearly a voracious reader, and you have this desire to learn and to improve yourself. And I mean, the sky's the limit with you. I've heard about some of your goals that you have with your brokerage and your investments and your conversations with Tyler Cauble. I want to ask you, thinking back to cold calling, your job cold calling, and your endeavors of working with an NFL team, playing football at a collegiate level, and trying out for the Oakland Raiders, and just going through some of these experiences, what do you think those difficult experiences taught you, and how did they prepare you for what you're doing today?
There's some really good commonalities, Jonathan. One being they were both very humbling experiences, right? And, you know, making that many phone calls per day, you have to get really okay and comfortable with being told no. And you have to really craft your message, right? I mean, you have to be able to intrigue someone very quickly off of a phone call and know how to follow up in the right way to be able to get any kind of traction in that. But you're going to get told no a lot. And so that was one. Same at the NFL, right? I still remember, you know, being in the film rooms and they sat down a playbook, but about that thick, you know, which is about 5 inches thick. And I was playing center, so on the offensive line. So I needed to make a lot of different calls before I was even snapping the ball and then try to block this Division I All-American defensive tackle in front of me that has, you know, has a lot more reps than I did at the time. And so those were very humbling experiences. And what I would say is that, you know, you need to be able to be coachable. And it is one thing that my wife continues to tell me about myself is, you know, you're willing to take feedback and you're willing to learn and continue to get better. And you don't take that necessarily personally. And if I had to make a prognostication about kind of the United States people, it's that we're way too soft and our feelings get hurt way too easily. And when they meet a New Yorker or they meet someone from a different country that has been through a lot of stuff, I'll say. I don't know why New Yorkers are this way. They just are. I don't know what's up about that. But I throw New Jersey in there too. Lots of real estate guys up there that I talk to. But at the end of the day, they have experiences that really, you know, lend them to being tough, and words don't really hurt them as much as maybe they do us, right? And so I think that's one thing. I have hanging up in my office right here, but it's hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times, and good times create weak men, and weak men create hard times. And it's not just men, it's women too. It should say men and women, because some of the strongest people I know are absolutely women. So at the end of the day, though, that's what was able to help me and prepare me for that next step, was that not there was being no more fear around being denied or told no or taking that personally, right? And somebody, one of the sales trainers, probably Ron Willingham, that I worked with way back in the past, was, you know, they're not denying you as a person. They're denying the offer that you are making. And that is up to you to create that to be more compelling. And so you should be not taking that personally, other than the fact that you need to become better. And so it was the same thing on the football field, right? I mean, if you miss a block or you don't make a call, you know, you should have been more prepared to be able to do that. Now, if you're physically capable or not, that is a different conversation. But if anybody's at that level, you're probably physically capable enough to at least be in the room or on the field. But your mental preparation can be light years ahead if you're able and willing to do that. And I think that we see that with, you know, Patrick Mahomes, with Tom Brady, with Michael Jordan, with Kobe Bryant. Listening and reading these stories around their preparation is just insurmountable, the amount of work that goes in from a mental side. So those are some of the commonalities that have helped, you know, that I've learned from making cold calls, playing football, that have been able to translate over to this business now is, you know, I got thick skin, and thick skin is needed in any type of entrepreneurial endeavor, but specifically in real estate, because, you know, the real producers and the real top investors, they didn't get there by happenstance most of the time. They're there because they worked hard for it and or they've built something from nothing. And that takes a lot of grit and it takes a lot of learning lessons across the way. And so that's been really instrumental for me, I think. And that's been ingrained in my psyche, which is, you know, being told no is not no to you as a person. It's no to what you're offering, and it's up to you to become better and create a more, you know, clear, concise, and compelling offer for someone to garner their time.
Logan, I want to ask about your portfolio and how you're spending your time today. So I know you've been heavily involved in multifamily, and you have for several years. When you were talking about what your portfolio looks like, you said you've got lots of multifamily units, but you also talked about a significant amount of commercial real estate. So What I want to ask, what else do you own besides multifamily? What does that side look like? Sure. And what do you, on the brokerage side, what do you find yourself being involved with over there?
Yeah. Well, I would say that we're opportunists in the sense that I'm always looking at basis for real estate. And, you know, when we purchased the majority of that multifamily was in a period of time when other people were not doing that. There was a fearful, you know, sentiment in the marketplace. Everybody was tracking the National Multifamily Housing Council rent tracker. I still remember that's probably the most used website at a certain point during the COVID-19 pandemic to see, you know, what the tracking was. And that's when we were purchasing multifamily. So we really have not stepped back in multifamily since 2021. And so really, it has been honestly looking at which deals did we put long-term debt in on a really great basis that people are willing right now to actually pay because of the interest rate, a marginal rate of return in our opinion, that would be like, you know, way better for us to go execute on because we don't even have to execute on the value add plan, right? And so we were able to exit a couple of those types of opportunities. So I'm highly focused on the dispositions of certain multifamily assets. I am definitely still open to and interested in looking at commercial properties, and I'll dive into that here in 1 second. And then on the brokerage side, I'm a firm kind of believer. My stance right now, especially if anyone tuned into the recent Tyler Cobble episodes, is, you know, these brokerages, boutique brokerages, are a great marker. They're a leading indicator on where the market might be going, because that is not going to show up in market reports or data that we can see currently. But that's what we're talking about, looking through the windshield. So on the commercial side, you know, I'm a really, this might be a little contrarian, but I'm really advantageously, you know, looking for and continuing to acquire neighborhood retail shopping centers with no anchor. So unanchored neighborhood retail shopping centers in areas that have median household incomes of 75,000 and above, vehicles per day, about 15,000 on the streets that it's located on, and in really good submarkets, because they are not building that. They cannot build that in those areas because there's no land, because it's been developed for some other type of use and or it's just not available. And those service-based, e-commerce resistant tenants are doing really, really well. And they did really well during COVID-19. Another trend on the retail side, I would say, is, you know, a lot of these owners of these properties, they might have gotten burned during COVID-19 with, you know, weak tenants that weren't willing to pay. And so they really strengthened their rent roll and their tenant mix over the last couple of years. And that's showing up. Wall Street Journal is talking about how retail is the darling of the commercial real estate industry. And so, you know, pre-COVID, we actually, going into COVID, of March of 2020, I believe that was 2020. Yes, 2020. Can't believe that's been 4 years ago now. It's March 21st. But March of 2020, we had $35 million of neighborhood retail shopping centers under contract. Walked away from every single one of those because of, you know, not knowing what was going to happen. So we have been stepping back into that space. Additionally, I'm a really big firm believer of the onshoring trend of manufacturing and supply chain type of businesses that need to control their supply chain. So I love flex industrial buildings where you have a smaller mix of office in the front of the building and you have warehouse in the back of the building. And I like the footprints of 20,000 to anywhere between 100 and 125,000 square foot, multi-tenant flex industrial buildings. We own one of those here in a great submarket in Kansas City that's about 215,000 square feet, and it's just been an absolute home run for us. Outside of that, we have five of those neighborhood retail shopping centers now. And, you know, we have one office building that I'm sitting in here right now that we completely redeveloped and leased up. So that's kind of what the portfolio looks like. As we are looking for, you know, acquisitions, I mean, we have done one in the last 2 years. So, you know, not a whole lot of new acquisitions. And so a lot of my time right now is spent getting ahead of what I'm calling this tidal wave of transactions that I do believe is going to happen. And it may not happen in the headlines that people see. However, Blackstone, Kimco, Fundrise, Goldman Sachs, you know, all of these large players are starting to either raise more money for real estate and or are already deploying that in real estate. Blackstone alone, I believe, has over $300 billion of capital that they're willing to deploy. But, big but, anybody that's listening to this, don't worry about that. They're not buying the assets you're bidding on, okay? It is just simply a data point to keep in mind. They have the strongest, the best, the largest data teams that are mining absolutely every data point that they possibly can to make very, very calculated bets, okay? But they have to deploy massive amounts of capital. So one, you're not going to outbid them. Two, the seller wants to sell to them anyways because they're paying the highest price. And three, you're not competing at that scale typically. So when I say that transactions are coming back, I see those headlines and then I look at our pipeline growing by 147% the last 2 weeks. And then I talked to Tyler and his pipeline growing 50, 60%. I've talked to other, you know, practitioners. I'm also watching what is coming online from a listing standpoint here in Kansas City. You know, we do a weekly multifamily minute and, you know, earlier in the year, there was maybe one to two deals every single week. This week alone, 17 new deals hitting the market. So that tells me that I need to get ahead of this transaction tidal wave. I need to really work with great buyers who might be interested in purchasing those. I need to focus on sellers because they seemingly are, I'll use the word capitulating in regards to saying, okay, I think that that is a pretty fair price. Let's go see if we can transact at it. So all of that to be said, that's kind of where my time is spent right now in what I'm doing, what I am focusing on, and looking forward to having a good year of transactions happening across all entities and hoping that the, you know, market really starts to turn in that favor, regardless of all of the doom and gloom that we can always find and see on the Main Street you know, headlines that we typically see.
What do you attribute the upcoming tidal wave of transactions to? And how are you preparing yourself to be a buyer in these tidal wave of transactions? And sorry for throwing multiple questions at you. Is the uptick of listings, does the pricing seem to be realistic, or is it just more of the old stuff of completely unrealistic pricing?
Yeah. Well, okay. So the first part being the markers in regards to and why I think the transaction tidal wave is coming. Anybody here should read Howard Marks, Mastering the Market Cycle. There's something here at play that is the strongest player in the space of investing. And I'm not just talking about real estate. And it's not the interest rates. It's not the economic climate, it is investor psychology, because investors control the capitals, the capital flows. And when investors start to feel more positive about the economy, about the prospectus, about the future, that is when things really start to move. And so Mastering the Market Cycle helps you understand rational exuberance, irrational exuberance, periods of time of recession. What has happened in history? Ray Dalio is also a phenomenal person to follow. He has a LinkedIn newsletter that I highly recommend everybody follow. His books are some of my favorite. They're all sitting right here. The Changing World Order, Principles, The Big Debt Crisis, all of these different things. It's very important to understand. However, investor psychology, and I am a believer right now that people are so pent up from the last couple years that they just want to get moving. They want to get something going. That's one. The second one, owners of commercial real estate. Okay. Baby boomers own, I think, $7 trillion of residential real estate. I got to imagine they own the most of commercial real estate as well. Baby boomers aren't getting younger. It's not the Benjamin Button effect. They're getting older. And as they get older, do their children truly want to take on that real estate, or do they just want a payday? Well, let's go back to what I said earlier. Unfortunately, you know, first generation wealth is usually kept, you know, second generation wealth is usually spent. And, you know, unless you do it right, and there's plenty of people that are, but you know, I think that that's a huge component here to keep in mind is what is going to happen with this real estate when they go to sell? Is it going to stay in the family, or is it going to hit the market? And I imagine a decent amount of that's going to hit the market. That's the second one. The third one, look, I think that the 18.6 year real estate cycle is playing out. I really do. And that's a book and methodology from Phil Anderson. Very heavy book, dense book, but I think it's worth a read. It's very interesting. Basically saying over the last 200 years of the land cycle here in the United States, you know, there is a cycle that happens about every 18 to 20 years, which is 14 years up, 4 years down. And there's a mid-cycle slowdown. We hit that mid-cycle slowdown during COVID. That was 4 years ago. We are, I believe, in the 11th hour on this, meaning that we've probably got this year and next year for real estate prices to continue to either stay steady and or increase. Because if you track the Green Street Property Price Index, we are now at levels that we have not seen since July of 2021, meaning the basis is this is the trough of COVID. That's where the basis is. And so Peter Linneman is an economist real estate professor from Wharton. He says, if you have capital and you have courage and a long-term ideal outlook, then you're going to be okay. So I think there's a lot of people that are going to say, all right, I'm going to take a longer-term outlook. I might not put financing on this, but I may go unload some of this cash because last time I checked, Jonathan, S&P 500, NASDAQ, Japan's stock market, where are they at? Bitcoin. Everything is at the highest level that it has ever been. I'll repeat that. Every single market is at the highest level that it's ever been. Why is commercial real estate not? Well, we lag all of those different industries. And so if I had to prognosticate on where it's going, I think it's going up for the next 2 years. So this might be a really good time for people to get in and start buying. And so all of those things combined, right? I mean, that's a lot to try to understand. And I just mentioned like six different books. But, you know, I've been studying this stuff for 11 years now. So it's not that I'm just reading all of these books right now. Okay. That's not how it's gone. But at the end of the day, I'm starting to see those themes and starting to see these things what I didn't believe to be connected. They are now all connected. So that's, I'll stop there and say that's kind of why I'm feeling in regards to the transaction tidal wave. And I can get into those other parts of the question here unless you don't have any questions about that.
Yeah. Super interesting. I mean, the amount of research that you do and the amount of wisdom that you have is mind-boggling. And so I just really appreciate, really admire that. So
thank you.
Yeah. Can you talk about maybe how you personally, you and your partners are preparing for potential upcoming transactions?
Yeah. You know, a couple things here. You know, I think that for us, we're actually, you know, going in much lower leveraged right now. And it has been a strategy of kind of resetting expectations with investors. And here's what I mean by that. Since 2010, we've been in the best, longest bull run in regards to property prices that I think we've ever seen. And so if you got in around 2010, you know, good on you. You know, that was awesome. Like, that's fantastic. It's gone up. Greater fool's theory has played out. Buy something, sit on it, don't do anything to it, put it back on the market and sell it for, you know, two times what you bought it for, whatever. That's gone in today's market. And so for me and for us, we're really looking at, okay, we need to have conversations with investors to say, hey, you know, that 5-year deal, that could turn into a 7-year deal. And also, you know, that's okay. But also we're seeing basis that is extremely, you know, advantageous for, you know, intrinsic value of the real estate. And so that is one thing to try to keep in mind is purchase price is permanent. You know, the financing is not permanent. That's temporary. And so is the real estate at an intrinsic level, extremely attractive. That's the number one thing. And it's starting to sort of get there. But I'll tell you, you know, there's probably plenty of deals that I would have gone after, you know, five, six, 7 years ago that I'm not even interested in because I've been in heavy value add situations. I've been in tougher areas, you know, to manage where I have to, yeah, I won't even mention it, but it's at the end of the day, we have evolved as a firm to looking for what I'll call less risky type of investments. And our capital has been willing to kind of take less risk. So as long as we feel like the return is there, and they do as well. So that's one, is really resetting expectations, going in with lower leverage, having a longer time frame. And so that's sort of what we're trying to get investors tabled for, which is, you know, that 15, 16, 17% IRR and the 8 to 10% cash on cash, you know, we can still make it look that way. But is that truly what the deal is going to do? I'm still getting pitched deals like that all of the time. And look, if you're assuming a loan and you're in a big market that's doing really well, okay. But also, I will just mention on the multifamily side, we have 670,000 to 750,000 deliveries coming this year. That's going to take some time to be absorbed, right? I mean, from the last 10 years, we have averaged about 300 to 350,000 new units every single year. So we're doubling that this year. Now, 26, 27, that's dropping off of a cliff, but that doesn't matter because the deals that people are buying right now will be impacted. If there's a brand new deal that's down the road and they're willing to do rent concessions and they're willing to take your market rents just to get filled up because they have to because of the debt structure that they put on their project, you might be in trouble. So that's just something that's a whole another episode just that you can dive into right there. But I think resetting investor expectations, taking less risk in this period of time, but really focusing on basis is exactly what we're doing right now, and do foresee us finding some new acquisitions this year.
Logan, will you talk about some of the deals, some of the hairy deals from 5 or 6 years ago that you maybe did do or wanted to do, and then juxtapose that against the deals that you're looking to do right now? You said you're looking to do less risky investments now. So will you compare and contrast what's changed over the last 5 to 6 years? What's different about the deals you're doing now versus 5 to 6 years ago?
Yeah, let me caveat that with my definition of risk is going to be a lot different than, you know, the person who has the fully integrated construction. They were a construction manager and love to get into heavy value add. But, you know, early on, I got involved in a project that was a building built in the 1800s in a really hot spot of Kansas City in the Crossroads. And, you know, it was a big historic readaptive use project. And, you know, we went all in and purchased this deal. And it was myself and one investor. And, you know, we had grand plans to create Airbnbs on the second floor and rent out the main level to a retail tenant. I will say, It is up and operating and done now, and it is a beautiful space. But what I missed in this was the fact that tuck pointing alone was going to be $150,000, that we were going to have to pay $25,000 to shut down one of the busiest streets in Kansas City to replace some water mains, that, you know, the wood floors were going to have to be completely replaced and not refinished, right? So those were some of the things that I missed on a heavy value add historic readaptive use project that I was not the right person to be understanding. And I actually used the wrong general contractor to actually walk that property with me. And he told me the numbers that I needed to hear and then got into the deal, closed it. And then the change order started So that was one big miss, was I got out of my comfort zone a little bit too much. I got out of my zone of experience and my genius. And so that was one thing that was a tough one. And what I had to do was write a $250,000 check back to that investor and say, hey, here's this money. I will help you get this thing done, and I'm going to walk away from it. And now it's operating. It's a beautiful space. It's fully leased up, and it's phenomenal. But I think that's still the only real estate deal that I've ever cried about. And I remember talking to my wife about this, and, you know, she's like, it's okay. You know, I wasn't crying that I was, you know, losing the money. I was crying that I was admitting defeat on a deal, right? And I had to, but it was the right thing to do. So definitely took some learning lessons away from that. You know, outside of that, you know, I had a really, you know, interesting, I had a really, I think, good and moral, you know, thesis about, hey, I want to try to do something really good about, you know, affordable housing here in Kansas City. And so we ended up buying a decent amount of Class C, you know, in rougher areas, thinking that we could go in and renovate them and manage them very well. And, you know, if you're not a company that is set up to really understand the social services components of affordable housing and or the turnover and the evictions and the skipped leases, and when you're trying to renovate units, you know, your contractor's tools being stolen in midday and their trucks being stolen, it can be really difficult. I had a building that was in a not so great area, but it was okay. You know, I think we renovated the same units four times because of copper being pulled out of them, of different damage that has happened. And so, you know, I think that the way that that has evolved is like, look, there are folks that are, you know, highly specialized that focus on those types of properties, and that is not something that we need to be trying to do. The way that we can try to impact that is, you know, go do what we feel like is our zone of you know, genius, focus on that, make good money in return for our investors and ourselves, and then give back to certain organizations, right, that really have, you know, an expertise in those. And that was a tough learning lesson as well. And so what we've focused now on, the last four multifamily deals we have bought have been, you know, 2000s and newer. They've been in Class B areas that have done really well for us. But look, I mean, as an investor, you want to get started and you want to solve the world's problems and you want to, you know, do all of these good things, and the basis looks really good. But, you know, those deals look great on paper, but the execution can be, you know, very difficult on that. Additionally, I had a mentor look at me early on, and I was talking to him about a multifamily property, and he said, you know, Logan, why in the world would I want anyone living in my real estate? And I didn't really know what he meant at that time. Well, after being a part of 1,500 units and managing around 600 here in Kansas City, I know exactly what he's talking about now. For example, we have a $12 to $15 million industrial building with five tenants, and we have a $12 to $15 million multifamily, you know, building with 200 tenants. And I will tell you that, well, I don't have to tell the listeners which one is easier to manage, that I don't get calls about, that I don't have to have full-time security on, or any of those things. So I think that's been the evolution for us, is looking at projects that are more scalable in regards to the resources that we have internally, and we can manage more efficiently and effectively.
Logan, you are embedded in lots of different areas of commercial real estate within Kansas City. You've got multifamily, you've got office, you've got retail, you've got industrial. I'd love to hear from you a little more about Kansas City. And for the benefit of listeners that aren't familiar with Kansas City as a market, will you explain what you like about it, path of progress, what you see for it in the future, those sorts of things?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And I've been in Kansas City for around 9 years now, and I've seen a lot of growth since I've been here. And I think it starts with a couple things. The first being, you know, infrastructure. And Kansas City is committed to infrastructure, whether that be the streetcar that's being continuing to be developed right outside my window here, or the new airport, or, you know, the busing and the transportation that is being done, or the work that's being done in the development of the riverfront here in Kansas City. Those are all major things that drive a lot of commercial real estate. The other part is affordability. You know, Kansas City is still, you know, pretty affordable in regards to different major metros in the United States. Now, it gets really hot here and it gets really cold here, and that keeps a lot of people away, and I understand that. But if you can get past that, you know, I can tell you some crazy stories about the, you know, the houses that I have lived in, and the sizes and the beds and bathrooms and things like that, and the prices. And people would be like, well, I get maybe about a fourth of that from where I live. And that is true. However, I think that this is a larger trend, but a lot of tech companies have really started to hone in on the Midwest, calling it the Silicon Prairie. And I think that's kind of a funny name, but it's true. You know, Google, you know, Panasonic, there's a lot of different businesses in, you know, Meta, all these different businesses that are moving what I will call, you know, warehousing and or jobs into the Midwest. Why? Well, you can get to about 80% of the United States from Kansas City in 2 days drive. And we have the new airport, which is driving a lot of that as well. So, you know, it's a huge transportation and logistics business here. We've got the Missouri River as well, which is driving a lot of, you know, I guess, intermodal type of railway. That's the other thing, is the rail here in Kansas City. I mean, we have huge rail here in Kansas City, so you can get a lot of product out of here as well. Agriculture is a massive one here for us in the Midwest, obviously. And then the medical systems, you know, KU Med is here. And from here to the pipeline to Wichita is, I think, the strongest pipeline of veterinary and schools and clinics in the country. And so that is another industry that is booming here in the Midwest. So all of those things combined, I do believe, create jobs, which, you know, those people, if they're moving here, which I think 3 to 4 people are moving to Kansas City proper every single day, which I don't know if that's a lot or not, but you know, it doesn't seem like that much. Maybe that number might be off. Maybe it's 30 to 40. I forgot. But regardless, population growth is decent. And I think that's because the jobs are here. It's affordable to live here. And honestly, the space, you know, I mean, I think that a lot of people want space. And when you look at Kansas City, it's a massive, you know, geographic location. I mean, Kansas City is, just from a square mile standpoint, is really, really big. Like from my house up to the airport, it takes 42 minutes and it's 42 miles. You know, that's driving on a highway with no traffic. And so it's just a really large area. So there's a lot more space. It feels a little slower here, I think, for a lot of people. And then we have, you know, a lot of things happening with sports teams around, you know, Kansas City. We've got the Kansas City Chiefs. We got the Royal Stadium moving downtown. We have the first women's soccer stadium that's built, and they had their first game on the riverfront. You know, that's leading edge. That's cutting edge. You know, a lot of cool things that are happening there. So, you know, and we have the best barbecue in the United States. So I'll just throw that in there as well. And so all of those things, I think people are like, oh man, it's not just a flyover state anymore. It might be somewhere for us to check in at. And all those things that I mentioned are really good demand drivers for investors who are looking to buy property that might not live here. And so what I've always said is, you as a commercial real estate practitioner in Kansas City need to be a pipeline from the, you know, the money that I will call is in money states to, you know, being the person who has the deals in the deal states. And this in Missouri, and these areas seemingly are, you know, really attracting a lot of outside capital, which is, you know, good and bad, I will say. But at the end of the day, I think there's a lot of reasons that people think that Kansas City could be, you know, the next Denver or something like that. Somebody said Austin the other day, and I just kind of laughed at him. But I do think that maybe Denver is a good case study to kind of see in where Kansas City could go. So I think that the projected growth and all the development that is happening is very strong, and the prospectus for the next 5 to 10 years is really good for Kansas City.
Logan, this has been an awesome conversation. I could talk to you all day, but I want to be mindful of your time. I've got a few more questions that are designed to be quick hitting questions, but if you've got a great story, feel free to take as much time as you want with them.
Okay.
Logan, if you could 10X a certain part of your business, what would it be and why?
Yeah, so many different places that I would do that. But I think the number one for me would be, you know, I'd love to 10X the amount of buyers that I could really service on a regular basis about Kansas City. And so, you know, I am actually putting a lot of thought and resources around, how do I take all the knowledge that I just spewed off in this episode and package it up into a book, into a free module and or training program that people can get acclimated with Kansas City. So that's a big focus of mine right now, is just 10Xing my ability to get the message out around Kansas City and where people should be looking and why. And so, yeah, I think that's my number one focus right now is trying to get people acclimated with this flyover state that is starting to hit people's radars.
What's the best deal you've ever done?
Man. Well, I mean, we actually just went full cycle on a multifamily project up in Des Moines, Iowa. And we purchased this about 19 months ago. And it was when, you know, debt was really cheap at the time. And we were very smart and or, you know, just less risk averse, I guess. And, you know, we locked in debt at 3.67%, you know, for 10 years. And so I actually just sold that deal. The market cap rate is about 6.7%. It stayed at 93% occupied and cash flowed the whole time we had it. I was not able to get in there and really renovate units. However, you know, rent growth was around 14 to 15% for that property organically. And I locked in a 4.1 cap rate in today's market as a sale in Des Moines, Iowa to a DST company. And I'd say that was an all around awesome, really great transaction and a huge win.
And so I have to ask you about that. Was your debt assumable for your buyer?
Yes, it was.
Okay. And so why'd you end up selling that? If you had 10-year debt locked in at a fixed rate, was it just opportunistic? Are you trying to divest from multifamily? What was the inspiration for selling that?
Yeah. Two things. First being, I'm tracking the supply that's coming online in Des Moines very closely. And in this submarket is a newer area, and there is a lot of supply coming online in that Altoona area. And so that was one big component of that, as I knew that rents would be really hard to continue to increase, especially if something happens where people might not be able to pay for, you know, rental increases. So that was number one. The second one was, look, I needed to add $250,000 to $300,000 of NOI to be able to sell at a 6 cap. Let's say if that cap rate, you know, bounced back to 6.7, I needed to add 250 to 300 NOI to get the same price that I was getting today at a 4.1 cap. And I just looked at, you know, my partners and said, look, guys, there's so much risk that we could go and probably could go execute on this, but we're going to get a price at a 4.1 cap today on this and hit the investor return that we need to. And it just made a ton of sense for us to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. When you lay it out like that, and man, when you explain the numbers in such a way that you just did, that you had to raise NOI by such an amount, mm-hmm. in just in order to break even, you know, based on a market cap rate. And then you think about all of the other multifamily deals out there that are
right.
Potentially going through a hard time. It'll be interesting to see how those shake out.
Absolutely.
So, okay. Worst deal you've ever done. You just shared one of your tough deals. It's okay if you say that was your worst deal, or if you have another one, I'd be interested to hear it.
You know, I think that probably the worst deal that I've ever done are the deals that I passed up on, you know, when we were looking at acquiring more retail and just didn't feel like we needed to get back into that space yet. You know, I passed up on some really great 9 and 10% cap rate deals that have just really outshone, and I could be locked in at a 4% rate and have 600 basis points of spread on those deals. You know, it really burns me. But at the end of the day, you know, you have to do what you can, and you have to make very clear and concise bets on where you're at currently. And so, yeah, I think that project that I mentioned previously was by far the hardest and toughest deal for me. Thankfully, I was able to, you know, do what I needed to do to make the investor whole there, but do feel like I missed out on quite a few deals, maybe two or two and a half years ago.
I think we've all had those moments where we just say, man, if I only would have bought, you know, 10 of those properties when I could have 5 years ago or 10 years ago. But you know what? If we could all tell the future, if we all had a crystal ball, we'd make different decisions. But all we can do is just make the best decision that we can with the information that we have at the time and hopefully be better off for it moving forward. Logan, are there any habits or daily practices that make a huge contribution to your personal or business success?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I'm a little bit military in this sense, but I'm not sure I've missed a workout in over 720 days. And so I get up, I have 3 young children. I get up before they do. Alarm goes off in my bathroom. So there's my number one habit is, it's not next to my bed. It's in my bathroom. I have to get out of my bed to turn that off. And you better believe my wife is saying, go get that thing turned off. So that's my number one habit is 5:15 every single morning. The second one, my faith is extremely important to me. And so making sure that I connect with the higher power, God, whatever you want to call that for yourself, every single day is extremely important for me. So that's my second thing that I do. And then I get the body moving. You know, I try to get those endorphins going and make sure that I win the morning so I can win the day every single day. The other part that I do, and this is while I'm on the treadmill, is I write my LinkedIn posts. So I don't know if I've missed a LinkedIn post in, you know, probably 4 or 5 years. And so that's one thing that I do, but also the power list. This is Andy Frisella methodology. So basically, you know, transitioning off of a to-do list and saying, okay, if there are top 5 tasks and or conversations, projects that I need to get done today, what are those? Some days you don't have 5, but mapping out those 5 every single morning. And then I share that with my team, and they share theirs as well with me every single day to know what each other is working on. If I can get that done that day, then I can mark off a win for that day. And then reviewing the previous day the next morning as well. So the power list is extremely important on that front as well. I'm really, really, really big on mental health. My wife has gone through some mental health challenges in the last year and a half. And so whether that means journaling or talking to someone or, you know, working out or, you know, or counseling, you know, all of these different things right now is a huge component to that. And, you know, so I'm working on that on a regular basis is meeting with people that give me objective feedback on what I've got going on in my life, because I've learned that blind spots is what causes the most pain. And if you can limit those blind spots by having other people pour into you and or objectively telling you what that looks like, then that's extremely important. So I'm a high advocate for having a coach and a counselor and people that can really help you propel forward. So that's another, you know, daily habit that I use. You know, and I use the Heroic app. This is from Brian Johnson, and it's an app that actually tracks my MVPs, my most valuable priorities in my faith life and my family life and my business life and in my personal life, you know, and my health. And so I've got, you know, each category has its own, you know, habits that I'm checking off anymore, and I don't even have to get in the app anymore. I know exactly what they are, and I'm focused on those. So those are some really great things to start your day. I think bookends are extremely important, meaning start your day well, ends your day well, because the middle of the day is usually what you can't really control very much.
What's your top tip for finding deals or connecting with sellers or buyers right now?
Yeah. I mean, having valuable information. This is a business. This is a knowledge-based, you know, business. And so, you know, you can basically, you know, I'll call it somewhat like insider trading. You can have insider trading knowledge if you're a commercial real estate investor or practitioner by getting out there, meeting with people, aggregating information in a way that people can really understand very, very easily. And people don't, you know, they might not be like, you know, Jonathan, they might not be like you and I. They may not be a learner or a growth seeker or somebody like that. And so if you can give it to them in bullet points, they find that extremely valuable. People are busy. And busier than ever. And their attention is extremely limited. And everybody's vying for attention. Those little supercomputers in our pockets, they are great, but they are terrible at the same time. And so you have to be able to garner people's attention. So you need to have knowledge, experience, and or information that they find valuable. And I think that's the best piece of advice I could have for finding sellers and finding deals.
Is there a book, podcast, YouTube channel that has been impactful to you that you'd recommend to others?
Oh, so many. I'll say on the I don't listen to a whole lot of podcasts anymore, believe it or not. I'm a huge Audible guy, so I believe that people spent the time to write a book. I might hear Ed Milet on a podcast or Jonathan, you on a podcast, and I'll go see if they wrote a book, and then I'll read that book, because to me that's usually some of their best information that's been aggregated into a book. So, but on the book side, you know, a couple books that I read every single year. You know, you mentioned 10X. Well, I listen to Grant Cardone's 10X Rule every single year. I think that's a great, phenomenal book. I really do. Hate him or love him or whatever. He's very polarizing, but that book was phenomenal. The second one is by Tim Grover, my man Tim Grover, Relentless. He was Kobe's coach. He was Michael's coach, and his book is just absolutely phenomenal. So being able to understand the mental game of business and entrepreneurship is extremely important. So those are some books that I read or I really love, and I could name off a lot of them. And then, you know, LinkedIn, you know, phenomenal place for people to go follow certain newsletters and or get up-to-date information. I really think that platform's doing a really great job.
Finally, Logan, if listeners want to connect with you, learn more about you and your businesses, where would you like to send people?
Yeah, find me on LinkedIn. I'm there every single day. So it's Logan Freeman, Mr. Kansas City. You won't miss me. I'm there. I'm active. I'd love to connect with you.
Logan, this has been a fantastic conversation. You are like a fountain of wisdom. It just keeps coming out. And I just love this conversation. Love listening to you. So thank you so much for joining me.
Well, it was my pleasure, Jonathan. Thank you for having me.
Listeners, thank you so much for listening. We so appreciate you being here. If you enjoyed this conversation, reach out to either one of us. We clearly love talking about commercial real estate, and we would love to connect with you. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, take care.
This content is for entertainment and informational purposes only. It is not financial advice, and it is not an invitation to buy or sell real estate or make any investment decisions.